Good morning, and welcome to New Books Network, the African American Studies category. Today, I have with me the award-winning poet, Patricia Spears Jones, author of A Lucent Fire, New and Selected Poems. Hello, and welcome, Patricia.
Hello, and welcome back to you. It's fun to hear your voice again.
It absolutely is. Well, of course, I'm going to ask you the great question. How does it feel to be an award-winning poet?
It feels very good. I am very grateful to Poets and Writers and the Jackson Poetry Prize people for selecting me. But really, it was totally out of the blue, and it was for my body of work. And for that, it just makes the last four decades of my life look a whole lot better because I've been working really hard for a long time. So I'm glad to be an award-winning poet.
Four decades of work. That's a lot. That's a lot of work. Because oftentimes, I know for me, when I see the award-winning poets, I wonder, what is it that they wrote? Because unlike a novelist who just does a book, you just said your body of work, four decades worth of work. So have you always been a great poet?
No, I've always been a poet. One doesn't start out great. One starts out like everything else as a journeyman or journeywoman, I guess. And you sort of build your skills and you expand your ideas and you, if you feel like you have the talent and the drive, you keep doing it no matter what. And that is how I got to be a really, really, I think, a very strong poet. I think I'm one of the best of my generation.
Excellent, excellent. Are there responsibilities that come with this award?
No.
Really? They just give you the money and you get to just keep writing?
Yeah. It's basically, it's an award that sort of says you as a poet should be known by lots more people. Because your work is really good and really is part of the dynamics of the conversation around the culture. And by the way, here's some money so that you can take the time to do what you do. And so it's given me a chance to pay off a whole lot of bills that needed to be paid and to be able to live fairly comfortably if I manage things right for another couple of years.
Well, congratulations again. And so how did Lucent Fire come about? Because it's a collection of poems.
Well, about 10 years ago, Alan Kornblum, the late editor, publisher, and founder of Coffee House Press had asked me to consider doing a collected poems. He says, you got, you know, several books out now and, you know, maybe you should start thinking about that. And I thought, really? I hadn't even thought about doing a selected. But then, and then he got very ill. And he kind of finished up some work on some other poets whose work that he had been really championing for a long time. And in the meanwhile, I had spoken with Dennis Maloney, who's a wonderful poet and translator, and whom I had read with in Buffalo, and who runs White Pine Press. And he said, well, if Alan does it, that doesn't work out with Coffee House, come talk to me. And so I went and talked to him, and we talked about this, and I realized that there are a number of, like my first book was a sonnet sequence, and it's been out of print since 1983, you know. So I was able to put all of those poems in this book because it is new and selected. So the selected is a really good way for people to see the work over time, and then the new work is what's, you know, I've been doing for the last, say, 4 or 5 years up until the printing of the book. So I had to, like, go through all of my work. It was pretty interesting. You know, and I realize that there are things I write about over time. I mean, you know, love, romance, the streets, you know, the issue of race, et cetera. And then there are ways in which I feel like I have grown better as a poet and smarter and tighter and more focused. And so I felt like that was really, it gives you great pause to see a whole lot of work on the floor as you were like going through it, going, should that poem go in there? Yeah, why not? You know, and there's some things I had to, you know, I had interesting conversations with my editor because my last book, Painkiller, has a lot of fairly erotic poems in it. And Dennis was like, didn't want to put them in. And I said, oh, no, they have to go in. Not all of them, but, you know, that's what that book was about. You can't not do that. And so it was like an interesting conversation around what is essential about each of the books that I wrote and what I think really represented each of those volumes well. And it took a year, but I'm glad that I was given a year to really work on this and to come up with something. I feel incredibly proud of this book.
And as you should, Painkiller. Huh, so let's give the audience a little taste of Painkiller, which is on page 97 of your book. So I can taste the metal, lose my desire for red meat. Relax every muscle, relax emotion, relax the time of day. I can give you the time of day. What I talk about is how love eludes me. No, what I talk about is what's wrong with me. No, what I talk about is what will happen to me. Fear is the secret. This is wonderful. That's a painkiller. Metal in the mouth. I love the way you talk about losing red meat. And although you have this painkiller of fear, I mean, of course, I can say whatever I want about the poem because that's usually how it's what we can do. What I love about it is how stark and wonderful it is in the words where a painkiller is something that relaxes every muscle. And usually we want that relaxing because of some type of fear. And at the same time you talk about this fear, you have this wonderful blues that moves into the poetry, right? This blues work that moves in here from Mary J. Blige.
The Painkiller is really interesting because it's one of those poems where I wrote it and it's so sharp. It is so, because the ending of it is really very good. It's very bleak, actually. And it says, and a recognition that the murderer and the martyr, the adulterer and the healer can at any moment change positions, become the other. It simply depends on how much pain you need to kill. And when I wrote that, I was like shocked by my own boldness in that poem. And I almost threw it away because it was so shocking. Yeah, and I was reading it to my friend Peter Covino, and he said, "Girl," you know, to me, Peter, "Girl, this is great," you know, and I went like, "Okay, Peter," you know, and I felt like I think I needed to hear someone else tell me it was okay to be that bold, and you know, because sometimes you know we all have those nagging voices in the back of our heads that say, maybe not. And, that's really great when it may not be. And so this is one of the ones, I think anything that really sort of rocks your world as a writer is probably the thing you have to finish, you have to do, you have to present and see what happens. And that was one of them.
Wow. I like the way you said, you thought about throwing it away. Because sometimes, you know, you write or one who creates wants to keep everything. So it's so honest to say that sometimes you do have to throw it away. Sometimes someone does have to remind you, this is bold. This is good. Because you're right. a recognition that the murderer and the martyr, the adulterer and the healer can change positions, right? It gives us, that's a fear that we have, that we can be as the other person, as hard. Yeah.
Thank you. And yeah. we need to understand that and realize that, because the last thing that anyone who seeks justice can do is to assume that they cannot become the kind of person that they want to bring to justice. There have been any number of times when we have seen that happen. And if you don't kind of recognize that, you're not dealing with the fullness of humanity. And part of the fullness of humanity is the horrors of it. And I think that was what I was trying to, because it's one thing to talk about one's own personal sadness or, loss, but it's another to sort of think about who are you in the huge scheme of things, in the huge scheme of humanity. And we have to, we have to kind of go into that macro sense of the world as well. So I'm glad that Peter gave me that look.
Yeah. Okay, so I did find the Mary J. Blige sings "No One Will Do" on page 137, right? From Swimming to America.
Oh, yeah. That's my James Brown tribute.
Yeah, exactly. Oh.
Yeah.
I believe this is so amazing. Reading through the book, you're talking 1 minute like the painkiller, and then all of a sudden you're right into the music, right? How do you do that? How do you come... the poetry, how do you take your poetry muse from the music into the words, into the thoughts?
I don't really kind of know. I just do. I mean, at this point, okay. I've been writing since I was 12 years old in one way or another. So at this point, I just do. But one of the things that really struck me and the reason why I wrote this poem were two things. One was, when James Brown died, that was pretty amazing. But they brought him to the Apollo, right? Because he had been there for like 1,000 times. And I live in New York City. And one of the things about New York is that you never see Black people act like Black people. I know that sounds strange, but really, people just don't act like Black people. They act like people in New York City. They can be from the Caribbean. They can be from Latin America. There are all kinds of Black people here. But just regular, ordinary, up from North Carolina, Arkansas, South Carolina, whatever, Black people, you hardly ever see them do anything. Well, that would change up fast. When Mr. Brown was put on that slab in the Apollo, thousands of people showed up, and then they went outside on 125th Street and danced and partied. It was unbelievable. I mean, the people just let loose, and say it loud, "I'm Black and I'm proud." And so, and I also remember that one of James Brown's wives tried to get a number of a car, what is the thing? If you have a car and tickets, trying to get these tickets removed because she said her husband was the ambassador of soul.
Sorry. That is good. So, the ambassador of soul.
I've been waiting to use that for years. And so, and so, like, all this stuff is stored in your mind, and you go, like, okay, James Brown. But then what really crystallized it was the picture, because they had a whole thing that said, no photographs, no photographs. And, of course, the New York Post, which is the tabloid newspaper, sent a photographer in there. He took a picture, and there was James Brown's wax face on the cover of the New York Post. And I just went from there. But I got a chance to talk about why Brown was so important, what it means to Black people to have somebody like him as a cultural hero, that and that there are ways in which we are often that the things that we do that we love the most are often depicted as if they are stereotypes, but they're not. And so so I got to play around with all of those things, but also just think of Brown as a winged messenger from the gods. You know, at the end, that's what he is. In my poem.
Yeah. So with that, how important is it, even for the poet, particularly you, because you do this so well, to have history, African-American history, in your poetry?
Well, it's extremely important. I grew up in Arkansas. I'm a Southerner. And Southern Black people, unless, you know, maybe the new ones, but, how else are we going to know about who we are and where are we, if we did not, in some way or another, document our own stuff? I grew up in a community where we had Negro History Week as opposed to Black History Month. And we had to, learn, poems by, County Cullen and Langston Hughes and all these people, and make our little presentations, in front of the school. And we had to do that because, especially in Arkansas, the capacity of the state to erase its Black citizens is unreal. I mean, there are, I grew up in the Delta, which is a beautiful, probably one of the most fertile places on the planet and one of the most violent. Friends of my sister pointed out a few years ago, their father had to cut down, this is like in the early 50s, cut down the body of a Black man who had been lynched, so that he could at least get a proper burial, in a town that was like about 30 miles from where I grew up. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that no one talks about. No one talks about it. And so history is extremely important. And because the other side of that, too, is that if you know how bad stuff has been, then you also can recognize when things do change. And there has been a great deal of change, not enough, but there has been change.
Three steps forward, two steps back. Yeah, thank you. And as much as African-American history you have in here and its importance that we see, there's also the famous poet Neruda. Did I pronounce his name right? Pablo Neruda.
About 3 days.
3 days. So why Neruda?
Why not?
I like that.
Yeah, really. I mean, he's sort of like that. He looms over all of sort of hemispheric writing. I mean, he was Chilean and he did win the Nobel Prize and he deserved to do so. He's fascinating. I mean, his first major publication was 20 love poems and one of desperation, which like every, young poet, especially the young male poet reads like, but he was a communist and he was an ambassador. He went around the world. He was exiled, which is why the movie Il Postino is one of the best because it's about his exile, sort of. He did things like he wrote odes to the watermelon, or odes to a tuna. Like these simple things, when odes were supposed to be to like big, large things, but... And he, he always had this large vision of humanity, but it always sort of goes back to his Chilean roots. And so there's this real sense of coming out of what seems like a backwater, and then going and literally being taken over the whole world. I mean, I think that's kind of great. And a lot of people have been in conversation with him. I mean, there are tons of poets who write Tene Ruda, but the poems that I wrote were called with Respuestas, and which means answers in Spanish, and they are answers to one of the last books that Neruda did, or at least that I know that was translated, is called Preguntas, obviously questions, and they're great questions, and so I just decided I would answer a few, and I did. And it was a joy to write those poems. It really was. Yeah. And so he's like somebody that everybody should. I mean, if he's not being taught right now, then I it's too bad.
It's too bad. Correct. Agreed. So it seems as though you like to talk back, you know, to other poets, because you also have Sylvia Plath, right? And I'm like, it's almost as though your muse, you would read someone else and then talk back to them and talk back to the poet. Is that like,
well, I think a lot of people do. I mean, allusions are like, you know, I mean, everybody from, you know, Allen Ginsberg, you know, talking to Walt Whitman in a supermarket in California to, you know, oh gosh, any number. I mean, I just did a whole thing with, there's going to be a big kind of celebration of John Ashbery's 90th birthday. And so all these poets are writing poems Ashbery. And so there's going to be a huge bunch of those. I mean, so I don't think that's unusual. I think that to me, all artists, all writers, poets, musicians, dancers, we're always in conversation with the people that were there before us. Sometimes we like what they had to say and we let them know. Sometimes we don't like what they had to say and let them know. Because we are not, we don't do this by ourselves. I didn't create the English language, good Lord. And I always remember something that Lorenzo Thomas, who's one of my mentors, said, that he always, up until near the end of his life, he would always read a poem, he did a reading by somebody else, so that it wasn't just his voice out there. He was part of this larger collective of poets in the world, you know, and not just contemporary ones, not just the ones that we know, but people who have been long gone. So, Sylvia Plath is fascinating because she's one of those people I read when I was in college. And this was back at the end of my senior year when I really didn't have anything else to do because I really finished off all my stuff. You know, I would go to the library every week and I would find a new book to read. And I read Lost and Enough because of that. And I read Anne Sexton because of that. And I look at art books because of that. And I found Sylvia Plath because of that. And then I found out that she had killed herself, and I went, oh dear. And then I found out that she killed herself on her birthday, which is really bizarre. And I went, oh dear. And then a few years ago, somebody did a whole thing about, you know, poems about Sylvia Plath. And so I decided that I would try to think about what would Plath be like in these different guises. And, the last one being, you know, she's being called, you know, Oprah is calling her up to say, come on my show and talk about how you survived your suicide attack. She says, what should I? But it was fascinating to think about her and to kind of, you know, she's a great poet. She's funny. She's creepy. She's scary. She's brilliant. And she's depressive. And it was so sad that she left so soon, but Lord, she left behind some amazing poems.
My final question to you is, what is poetry?
Oh, I don't know. I was just reading, I was reading Mira Rukeyser, The Life of Poetry, and she's actually very interesting. This was written in the 40s. It was written right after or during, I think, World War II. And she talks about poems as events. And I'm trying to find the writing where she says this. Because she's talking about, you know, consciousness and the rejection of poetry and all this other stuff. But I think what she really is trying to say is that when we make a poem, when we're sort of merging images and sound and memory and ideas, they're all coming together in a certain kind of way. They're not prose, although I love prose poems, but there's something about that coming together, the form that they take, that's just different. And depending on, you know, the culture that you are, you know, making these poems in, they could be mnemonic, you know, so that you remember every other line, like from Arabic poetry or Spanish poetry. It could be free verse, because that's something that Americans do fairly well. But they all have a lot to do with bringing those images, those sounds, that line together in a way that nobody else can do. So you will never mistake Yusuf Kumanyaka poem for a David Wallace Foster or David Foster Wallace novel. It just won't happen. You know, the line is different. The line is different. And I think that is that to me is what really is what works.
Before we say goodbye, is there anything you'd like to add that I didn't ask? One thing that you'd like to share about poetry?
Well, I think people need to not be afraid of poetry. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to not think of it as lightweight, because it is not. It is something that is extremely important. People have been making poems since the first tribes people came back from the hunt and were singing about it. And so we need to kind of honor that capacity. And also people need to read and they need to buy people's books. If you want the poets that you care about to survive in this society, you need to buy their books. You can buy mine, buy somebody else's, but you know, yeah. I don't care how you do it. Write a check, do Square, whatever it is, PayPal. But, you know, really and truly read it, share it, and don't be afraid of it.
Don't be afraid of it. Thank you so much. I love that. Don't be afraid of poetry. Read it. Excellent. Thank you, thank you, thank you for joining us. This was fabulous.
Well, you are more than welcome. This was a wonderful, I'm glad we were able to do this.